being a banker for 21 years almost.
That's okay. It's going to fuel you. It's still, I think, fueling me to this day.
Somebody that's a little bit bored should be waiting a long time. So people are just going to have to roll up their sleeves.
Try to make sense of it because there's so much information coming in and you don't know what's relevant and what's not.
The corporate world for 4 years as a CEO.
I'm not interested in having this small probability of losing a whole lot of money.
You need to be surrounded by other smart people.
Got me through the door because it's a pretty small group. And it's
Hello, everyone. This is your host, Maura Maya. Welcome to another episode of the Finance Podcast, where I explore the professional journey of individuals who have successfully built careers in the financial industry. This episode is particularly interesting as we will be talking about COVID-19 and its effect on markets and how this will all play out. My guest this week is Sean Finney. Sean is a managing director and head of the oil and gas acquisition and divestiture advisory business for Evercore Partners. Prior to joining Evercore, Mr. Finney was most recently a managing director and head of mergers and acquisitions for Scotia Waterous in the U.S. Prior to that, he was an oil and gas banker at Goldman Sachs and began his career as a corporate lawyer specializing in oil and gas transactions. So please enjoy my conversation with Sean Finney.
Hi, Sean. Thank you for being on the platform here with us today. It is a pleasure to have you.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Maura.
I want to get right into it. And before we get into understanding your day-to-day role as a senior managing director for Evercore Partners, I would like to discuss your story. How does it all start?
Well, I grew up as a kid in Saskatchewan. And when I was young, I guess 16, I decided that I was going to get an undergraduate degree, then go to law school, practice law, save my money, and eventually go to business school in the United States. And that's what I planned out when I was 16, and that's what I ended up doing. And so I went to the University of Saskatchewan and studied liberal arts, majored in economics. I then went to law school at the University of Western Ontario. I practiced oil and gas law in Calgary with Burnett Duckworth. Then I went to business school at Northwestern. While I was at Northwestern, I spent a summer working for RBC Dominion Securities in Toronto in investment banking. And when I graduated in 1995, I joined RBC full-time. And I worked for RBC in both Toronto and in their M&A group, then in Calgary. Then I was recruited by TD. Securities and their energy group in Calgary. Then I was recruited by Goldman Sachs for their energy group in New York. And then in 2003, my wife and I and our family moved back to Canada, and I worked for Scotia and their M&A group. In 2006, moved to Houston with Scotia. And then in 2011 was recruited by Evercore to start their oil and gas business in Houston. And when I was first recruited by Evercore, we had 5 people in our Houston office back in 2011. And now we have 85 people in our Houston office. So
that is quite the journey.
That is my career background. That might have been more detailed than you were looking for, but that's the
That's actually quite insightful. Thank you for sharing that with us. But I want to dig a little bit deeper, and I want to ask. I'm really curious to know what drew you to the world of finance. You know, you had this idea of doing your law degree and then going into the financial industry. But what part or aspect of the financial industry attracted you most?
Right. So that's a good question. So when I went to business school at Kellogg at Northwestern in 1993, I knew I had no formal business background. I had studied economics. I had practiced law. I had worked in in corporate law and oil and gas law, but I had no, and I was very interested in business, but I had no formal training in business. So I went to business school, not knowing, just knowing I was interested in learning about business, but not knowing what I wanted to do when I graduated. In fact, I thought that I might like to do market research. I had no idea, but I thought maybe that's what I wanted to do. When I got to Kellogg, what I realized was I really enjoyed studying finance and studying accounting. And so I thought, what is it? And I knew I'd like doing deals from my time working in law. So I thought, where is it that I can work in finance and accounting and do deals? And investment banking seemed like an obvious answer. So I started going to investment banking presentations. Most of the presentations were from banks in New York. And my first reaction was, man, these guys are jerks. so I thought, well, I don't want to be like them. But then Canadian investment banks started reaching out to me, and these were kinder, gentler investment bankers and folks who had worked on Wall Street and then moved to Bay Street for the most part. And so I thought they seemed more like me. And so I thought, well, I really connected with RBC. I thought they were a great firm, and I went to work with them for the summer and really enjoyed it. Just felt that working in Canada was a better fit for me than going to Wall Street and working in New York.
Reminds me of something I read where they said RBC nice.
Yeah. There was a dramatic difference between the investment bankers I met from Canadian firms and a lot of the folks I met from Wall Street. And eventually Goldman Sachs recruited me pretty hard, and I ended up working in New York with Goldman. And Goldman was a great firm. I mean, it had tremendous culture, tremendous people. And so the more exposure, because I didn't want to move to New York, but they just were very persistent. And the more time I spent with Goldman people, the more impressed I was. So I eventually did find my way to Wall Street, but started off on Bay Street.
And now you are a leading managing director in the oil and gas sector. And I want to ask about, what does a day in investment banking look like for you?
Okay. Well, for me, it's very different than for a junior banker. And just for the folks in your audience, just to explain the different levels in investment banking. So when we hire students out of college, they join us as analysts, and they work for us for 2 or 3 years, and then they often go work at private equity firms or hedge funds, or go work at a client, or go to business school. Sometimes they stay on and become associates. But typically they work for us for 2 or 3 years, then maybe go work at a private equity firm, then maybe go to business school. So when you first join out of college, you're an analyst. The next level is associate, and those are folks that we either promote from the analyst level, but most often hire out of business school. And then the next level is usually called vice president. And then there's a level called director or managing director. And then we have a fifth level called senior managing director. So there's a big difference in terms of what I do as a senior managing director or partner and somebody coming out of college, who would be, someone in at McGill who would be entering the world of investment banking in the next year or two as a analyst. But what I do day to day, very different now during the pandemic, but In my normal day to day, I'm usually on the road in front of clients, meeting with CEOs, CFOs, heads of M&A groups or private equity firms. And so I travel probably 80 to 90% of the time. Like I'm on the road typically 4 or 5 days during the week. So I'm visiting clients in Houston or Dallas or Denver or Calgary or New York or Los Angeles or Toronto, Oklahoma City, Tulsa, anywhere where there's oil and gas or capital interested in investing in oil and gas. So typically my days are spent in front of CEOs or heads of private equity firms, meeting with clients, either trying to win new business or working on existing M&A or A&D assignments, A&D being acquisition and divestiture assignments. And if I'm not meeting with them in person, then I'm typically back to back on phone calls with them. And my job is to try to win new business for Evercore or to lead the execution of M&A assignments. So I spend very little time in the office. In fact, I'm typically in the Houston office less than 30 days a year. So I'm on the road almost all the time. And I very infrequently actually sit at my desk and sit in front of a computer. I'm either going to meeting to meeting to meeting, getting on a plane. Sometimes I'm in 2, 3, 4 cities in one day. So I'm constantly on the go. So it's very rare that I'm actually in the office sitting in front of a computer. It's been a long time since I've done that.
I want to rip
up. Although during the pandemic, I have spent the last 9 months working from my guest bedroom and have not traveled at all. So it's been very different since March 15th.
I'd like to rip up the script here a little bit and discuss a topic that perhaps not many of our listeners are fully aware of, which is about work-life balance and the hours that need to be put in working in an investment banking career. Now, you've managed to build a successful career at the senior level with the intense hours that the industry is known for. What is your best advice for young individuals trying to break into the industry and who are going to be faced with these long working hours?
Yeah, so I was never an analyst. So I entered investment banking when I graduated from business school at Northwestern. So I joined in as an associate. But an associate's lifestyle is not that different than an analyst's lifestyle. So an analyst or associate, their lifestyle is very different than mine. There is some travel involved, but most of the time you are in the office. And what are you doing? You're doing a bunch of financial analysis. You're doing a bunch of modeling. You're doing research. You're putting together presentations. And it's a lot of analysis heavy, detail oriented work. Often you're working on more than one assignment or mandate at a time, and it's a lot of long hours. And again, most of it's at your desk in the office, and there are typically pretty small deal teams in investment banking, 4, 5, 6 people on a deal team, even if it's a $10 billion, $20 billion merger. So there's a lot of responsibility, even as an analyst or an associate. And many times you can be on calls, conference calls, client calls throughout the day, and then you have to do a lot of your work at night. And so I will admit that as an associate at RBC and at Goldman Sachs, I would often work 80, 90, 100 hours a week. Sometimes have to sleep in the office. It is very It is very time consuming, and it's very exciting, but it is very demanding, very time consuming. And investment banking isn't for everyone, because the long hours are not the hardest part. I think it's a lack of control you have over your time. It's a very service oriented industry. And so even as a partner, I don't have great control over my time. It's dependent on clients' needs. So I could find out Friday afternoon at 6 o'clock that I need to work all weekend or get on a flight and fly to London or something. I think that's the biggest challenge for people in terms of lifestyle is just the lack of control. And it can be a challenge balancing your personal life and your work. And I think especially as a young person, as an analyst or an associate, you almost have to think about it as I'm signing up to be available 24/7. Not that you will be, you'll have to be doing this job 24/7, but you have to kind of be available 24/7. And then when you get a break, be able to take that break. So if you're the type of person who likes a very defined schedule and knows exactly what they're doing every day and needs to have things planned out, it's very difficult. But it's also very exciting in that you're working on very important, very large transactions. You're playing an important role. And when I was at Goldman, I used to love the fact that I'd go to work on Mondays and not know, will I get sent to Germany this week, or will I be sent to Calgary, or will I, have to go out to Houston to work, and not knowing what exciting transactions I might be working on that week or where I'd go. So some people like myself, love that intense environment. For other people, it's difficult. So
I want to move forward and talk about market questions. So my next question is, what happens to M&A activity in the oil and gas sector amid the pandemic? And the last few months have been particularly rough for the industry. The sector has seen a wave of bankruptcies in the recent months after crude prices crashed. Will M&A only happen as a sort of band-aid for the industry, for the sector, pardon?
So that's a good question. And I don't think it's really pandemic related, but the biggest issue facing oil and gas today is it's a very capital intensive industry, and there's a lack of capital available for the oil and gas industry because investors are less interested in investing in oil and gas today than they have been in the past. And I'd say there's a couple of main factors for that. One is the returns in oil and gas over the last couple of decades have been poor. And so if you look at how oil and gas companies have performed relative to the S&P 500 or other industries, they have not done as well. And so I think that's making investors more reluctant to invest in oil and gas. But the industry also faces ESG issues, environmental, social, and governance issues. And so there's increasing pressure on investors for environmental reasons not to invest in oil and gas. And so with less capital available for the industry and weakness in commodity prices, it's been very difficult for folks who have a lot of debt to get the equity they need to get out from underneath that debt. And therefore, we've had a number of bankruptcies, a number of restructurings to turn debt into equity. But the bankruptcies are, the restructurings are only a short-term solution. And the reality in oil and gas, whether it's public companies or private companies, is we have too many small companies. And one way to make the industry more efficient, get costs out of the system, is to have mergers and have less companies. And so that is the big driver of merger activity in our sector. And there, you've seen a number of mergers this year. And I think that is going to continue, both on the with public companies and private companies. And the only thing that has stood in the way of more merger activity has been weak balance sheets. But as companies restructure and they fix their balance sheets, then they can participate in this merger wave. So I don't really think it's related to the pandemic. The pandemic has caused a short-term impact on commodity prices, which has probably caused more people to go into restructuring sooner rather than later. But regardless of the pandemic or not, there needs to be more consolidation in our space.
So this is a very interesting topic, and I want to talk about going further. So the current drop in oil prices we mentioned was very unsettling, pardon, as far as to what to expect going forward. How does a Democratic government, a Biden administration, affect the industry?
Right. It's a good question, and we don't know exactly, but I'm not too concerned that it's going to cause many dramatic changes in our industry. I think there's likely to be a ban on fracking on federal lands. So if your leases as an oil and gas operator, if your leases are from the federal government, that can make operating more difficult. Unlike Canada and the United States, a very small fraction of oil and gas leases come from the federal government, so that's not going to impact many lands or many people. I think the regulations are going to become stricter, and so it could take longer to get permits onshore in the Gulf of Mexico than it currently does. I think some of the ESG regulations are going to get stricter, but that was likely to happen anyway under pressure from investors. So I don't think that many people think that there are going to be dramatic changes to the oil and gas industry. And to the extent that a government did restrict production at all, will probably help commodity prices increase. If there was restricted production, that could help to get higher prices.
Wonderful insight. I want to move away from market questions and talk about guidance questions. And in particular, to what scale and or value do you attribute most of your success?
Well, I don't know how successful I've been, but I've been around for a long time, 25 years. I think to be successful in investment banking, what we do is not rocket science. I think to be successful in this business, though, but it is a very difficult, as we discussed from a lifestyle perspective, it can be very difficult and very challenging. I think being passionate about the job and really loving doing deals. And to quote Hamilton, loving being in the room where it happens, where strategic decisions are made by boards of directors and CEOs and CFOs with respect to the future of entire companies and whether they will continue, whether they will merge, whether they will sell the company. These are, to me, that's very, very exciting. So having a passion about the business, having a passion about doing deals, being very resilient, being able to live through a lot of ups and downs, because again, there can be a lot of pressure in this job and the hours can be long. And I think I've always had the ability to, no matter how tough things might get, to just keep going and stick it out. I think that's a real ability. when you're more junior, being strong analytically and having a passion for finance and accounting and really enjoying that and is important. As you get more senior, what becomes more and more important are having strong relationships, having a strong network, having strong relationships, becoming a trusted advisor to clients, and being someone that people value your insights and your advice and trust you. But I think through all of it, whether you're a junior person or a senior person, to succeed in investment banking, I don't know what the right word is. You need to be resilient or gritty or tenacious, mm-hmm. To just stick with it, because I've seen a lot of people that I grew up with coming out of business school or at RBC or Goldman that were at the same level as me who were very, very talented, but just did not have the desire or the tenacity to stay in the business. And again, it can wear you out. And so my ability to not get worn out and just keep going for 25 years is probably my greatest talent.
I want to continue with something you mentioned. One last question before we get to closing remarks. You talked about value and connection. What advice can you give to students on how to continue to grow and develop their networks while connecting remotely?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's not easy. First thing I would do is encourage all students to network. I think, look, recruiting is very important, and I can only speak from an investment banking perspective, but I know in investment banking that it's a hard industry to break into. Once you're in the industry, once you've worked in the industry, even for the summer, you're kind of in the door, and you'll likely be able to stay in the industry as long as you want. But investment banking can be a tough industry to break into. Students at McGill are fortunate that it's probably, across all firms on Wall Street, one of the top 20 schools that U.S. firms recruit at. And I'm assuming in Canada, it's probably one of the top three or four schools that investment banks recruit at. So students are fortunate they go to McGill because there's a lot of investment banking recruiting, both from Wall Street and Bay Street at McGill. And so I would take advantage of that in terms of any firms that are coming to campus or in the pandemic doing presentations remotely. I know we did one recently to participate in those. Any sort of coffee chats that people might be having, again, it might be remotely, to participate in that. Just take advantage of, you're lucky that you're at McGill, so anybody who's coming to campus, anybody who recruits, take advantage of that. Take advantage of the very strong McGill alumni base, whether it's in Montreal or Toronto or Calgary or anywhere else in Canada, or there are a ton of McGill graduates in the U.S. to make use of the alumni base and reach out to alumni and stay in touch with them, even if they're recent alumni, someone who graduated 2 or 3 years ahead of you, reach out to them, get to know them, see if there's anybody that they can introduce you to in whatever field or city you might be interested in. So don't be afraid to reach out and make connections, especially with alumni. And my advice for any alumni listening would be, always answer emails from young people, especially people from your school. It doesn't take much to answer their emails. It doesn't take much to return their phone calls. Somebody probably, I know a lot of people helped me along the way to get where I'm at. People should not forget that. They should pay it forward and help other young people trying to break into Wall Street or Bay Street. So I feel very passionately about that people take the time to help young people, especially people from their alma mater.
Along with this, I do want to thank you for taking the time to appear on the podcast and help both myself and my peers as we navigate the industry that is finance and trying to build careers. Personally, I truly appreciate the insight that as guests and as individuals who have worked in the industry provide so that I may better make decisions or I may better prepare myself as I embark on my professional journey. That said, I want to move forward to our closing remarks. And is there any last advice or last piece of advice that you'd like to give to our listeners, to the folks tuning in to the podcast, in terms of their career or any personal challenges? Any final remarks?
Well, what I would say is, look, I love my job. I wouldn't have stuck it out for 25 years if I didn't love it. I love this job. It's very, very exciting, but it's not for everyone. But so don't go into investment banking because somebody tells you you should, or you think it's glamorous, because it's not. Go into investment banking because you're really passionate about it, that you have a really strong interest in the capital markets, in mergers and acquisitions, in playing a role in the strategic direction of companies. But if you love doing deals, if you love being in the room where it happens, I think it's a fantastic job where you're going to get experience as a 22, 23, 24-year-old that would be unparalleled in terms of the experience and the responsibility you would get. And the other thing I would say is just be resilient. If you get into this industry, there will be ups and downs. But don't get discouraged. Just stick it out, because it can be a great long-term career.
I want to be respectful of your time. Thank you for all the wonderful insight. It has been an amazing conversation and a pleasure to have you today on the podcast.
Thank you, Maura. Thank you for inviting me, and have a great weekend.
That was my conversation with Sean Finney. It was an absolute pleasure having him on the podcast, on the platform. A truly wonderful conversation. As always, this podcast is powered by the McGill Investment Club. Remember to stay safe and stay tuned. There's always more coming up.